Chuck. Everybody still looks bright-eyed today. This is a good sign. And as they're coming up, I'd like to take this moment to introduce the moderator. And this is a tough job today. This is someone that's got to be a Berber woman, Berber woman wannabe. You're not a Berber woman yet. Well, you may be after this panel. One of my my director of communications has warned me that I may just have some protests soon from, I don't know, some action because I've made that comment. But whatever. It's what we all love about the city. Anyway, I'd like to introduce Emily Lloyd, who has taken on the job of being our moderator in developing a plan of action. And this is a tough job, but Emily's up to it. Emily Lloyd is also Commissioner Emily Lloyd, and as that, she is the head of the Department of Environmental Protection for New York City. Emily was appointed by Mayor Bloomberg to head this agency in February 2005. The Department of Environmental Protection is responsible for managing New York City's drinking water supply, wastewater collection and treatment systems, handling hazardous materials emergencies, toxic site remediation, overseeing asbestos removal, and enforcing the city's air and noise codes. Emily's department also has substantial responsibility outside New York City in managing and protecting 2,000 square miles of their watershed lands in the Catskill Mountains and the Hudson River Valley. That's very beautiful country, Emily. Prior to heading up this agency, Commissioner Lloyd served as Executive Vice President for Community and Government Affairs for Columbia University and was Columbia's Executive Vice President for Administration for 10 years. She was Commissioner for Sanitation under Mayor Dinkins. She also was Director of Business Development at the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey and Commissioner for Traffic and Parking for the City of Boston. Emily, thank you so much. We are so so glad to have your energy, your smarts, to lead us to this tough topic this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Well, as the only at least self-identifying water system manager from the East Coast, I had originally planned to briefly present some highlights of our climate change experience in New York City. But after listening yesterday, I thought that I could spare you more anguish and just maybe tell you a brief New York story instead, hopefully in a New York minute. I live in Brooklyn on a block of brownstones with stoops in front and little backyards in the back. And one night, quite a few years ago, when my son was quite small, we left our backyard where there was a huge August moon rising, and we went down the stoop in the front and up the block and up the stoop at a neighbor's house and out into their backyard where there was a party. And when my son got in the backyard, he said to everyone there, "Oh, we've got a moon just like that in our backyard." So let me just say, we've got a climate change just like yours in our backyard. The time spent yesterday, at least for me, was very well spent and really leads up to the business of today. Yesterday we talked about the state of knowledge. Some of it was wonderfully obvious. David pointed out that water goes downhill and collects in low areas. Some of it was breathtakingly vague when it comes to trying to make a billion-dollar decision about something. We talked about simple solutions like duck bills. We talked about bold actions in diversifying drinking water supplies in San Diego. We heard about thinking across disciplines, reaching across jurisdictions, winning over regulators, environmental groups, economic development agencies, and environmental justice advocates, and getting them to work with us. That was a terrific day, and if we'd all gone home last night, I think it probably would have been time well spent. It certainly would have been for me. But today we have the opportunity to make it much more useful, because it's amply clear that climate change is happening to all of us right now as water systems managers. And if we can learn together and act together, we can probably be more effective more quickly. So that's what we're going to try to do today, and here's how we're going to do it. We're going to use those five topics up on the screen to frame the discussion, but we don't want them to constrain the discussion. It's just to give it a little structure, and we want to hear from as many people as possible, panelists certainly, but all the rest of you as well. We want to hear about what decisions you think need to be made quickly. We want to hear about what strategies you think have been useful in moving forward decision-making and taking action in your field of work. We want to hear about what you need that this group could help you with so that you could be more effective in taking on and acting effectively on climate change. We're going to spend about 20 minutes on each area, and as we begin each discussion area, I'm going to ask a volunteer from the panelists to speak briefly, and then try to get at least two, maybe three participants from the floor to comment. These are not questions, these are comments, and if we have time, we'll go back to a panelist. I'm going to ask people to stick to 3 minutes, and the crew of eagle-eyed and agile microphone carriers, I assume, are available today, and they will find you. Are they available today? Great. They will find you, and then when 3 minutes is up, they will leave you. Tough love, so that we can hear from as many people as possible. We will break at about 10:45, so I can eat a chocolate muffin if there's one left. And then at the end, we will do one more session on, I think it'll be technical and engineering, and then leave time for some last thoughts. But that won't be your last chance to have last thoughts. I'm told the website is going to be held open for several days. So after you leave, if you haven't had a chance to speak, or if you think of something over the next couple of days, please write to the website so that the staff can include it in the thinking. And we also... I think all of you have been given cards, and we wanted you to use those to think, and I'll remind you at the end, about two particular questions. What can our agencies do collectively to combat and respond effectively to climate change? And question two, what specific actions are you doing now to combat climate change, or what specific ideas do you want to share with others about climate change? And if you will hand those in to staff at the end, all this will be taken by them and synthesized into an action plan that will focus on not what we're going to do for the next 30 years, but steps that we can take together in the near future to continue to develop our capacity to work together and lend each other assistance, insight, and support. So having said that, we're going to start with the first topic, which is public engagement. And I would like to ask one of our panelists to volunteer to speak briefly about public engagement. Barry.
I'll start.
I see volunteering in your eyes.
Two thoughts. First, a terrific start at public engagement is evidenced by this conference. The PUC has done a real service, not just to the water community, but because of the attention from the media and other stakeholders who are here, to the whole Bay Area, and increasing the awareness of this issue. So building on this conference is something that I think is tremendously valuable, and not just for the inside water community. Second, simple public awareness measure I wanted to mention because it came out of our experience in California. A number of water agencies decided to support AB 32, California's climate change bill, but that actually started because water agencies started asking themselves in conversations with folks who worked on climate issues if they thought we needed to create a mandatory cap on greenhouse gas emissions in order to make progress. And the answer they after giving it a great deal of thought, the answer a number of agencies came back with was yes, it's not a silver bullet, but it's part of the solution, and we need to take that step. And a number of folks who we work with on climate said to those water agencies, well, why don't you start simply by saying that publicly? And that's not the same as taking a position on a particular piece of legislation, but that sort of policy statement to the general public that climate change has significant water supply impacts and we can't just prepare for the worst case scenario. We need to think about mandatory climate caps as a policy issue before we get to the legislative and regulatory issues. That's something that we would urge the water community to think about in terms of communicating with the public.
I certainly think conveying to people what we have realized and getting it onto the radar screen is going to be very important. Is there someone from the audience or the participants that could help us think about participation, public engagement?
Dave Erickson, Climate Protection Campaign, Sonoma County. We're a nonprofit organization in Sonoma County that's focused on local solutions to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And our approach to this issue has been to develop a community climate action plan, which we're currently launching. And that's actually one of the reasons why I'm here, is to sort of probe the knowledge of the audience, of the group, to find out what can be done specifically in the water and wastewater sectors. But we have are trying to conceive this thing as being sort of a synergistic combination of transportation, looking at transportation, land use, water use, wastewater, and solid waste and energy, all those things sort of working together to bring a focus on how we can achieve significant reductions in the community. And like Jared said, where the emissions actually occur is locally, and so that's kind of what we're focused on. But the public outreach for us, I think, has been a key element, and we're looking at working with community environmental groups, Sierra Club, and so forth, but using the plan kind of as a focus, both in terms of how you do it and in terms of what specific actions can be taken in the community.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm Paul Helliker. I'm the general manager of the Marin Municipal Water District. And this may carry over into the planning issues item, but one of the things that we're doing in California is, and this is sponsored by Proposition 50 and Proposition 84, is integrated regional water management planning. And all the regional entities and water districts and others have been participating in this for the past year. But one of the things we've been talking about in the Bay Area is overlaying that planning process with a focus on climate change. And I was talking with Lester Snow last night about this, and I'm glad to hear that the Department of Water Resources is going to promote that for planning efforts throughout the state. But that really is a good forum for doing the work that we're talking about here today with all of the partners, the wastewater agencies, the local land use agencies, and the water districts and others. And there is a public engagement component as part of that, because when we develop the plan, one of the elements that we try to do is reach out to community groups and other stakeholders. So I think that's one place where California already has a process in place, and it would be helpful for all of us to focus on climate change as part of that process.
Thank you. Yes.
Good morning. Larry Wilson, Santa Clara Valley Water District. I was thinking as a product of this summit that we should come up with a statement about the reality of the science where we see it today. I mean, we've all agreed, I think, that certain things are really happening. We ought to state the obvious as a statement from this summit signed on to by the participants here. And if we could do that, along with some of the backup issues about how do we plan the action plan and things like that, we could probably put out a product that could have value nationally.
Thank you. I think we are not going to try to take action today, but in the follow-up that we will be circulating, and there will be an ongoing dialogue through that mechanism, those are things that we can consider, because I think everyone feels a lot of need to get out with some of the things we've formed consensus about over the past day. Let me go back to a panelist.
No.
Lester.
Well, a couple of thoughts in terms of public engagement. My mind goes immediately to the whole need for a sustained communication strategy. I mean, virtually a marketing strategy. This is a big long-term issue. The way we talk about it now, we all talk about it in different terms, different sound bites, and there's no sustained program. And we're actually, in my opinion, when we're trying to get the public interestedness, we're competing. We're competing with Iraq, healthcare, immigration, trans fats. I mean, just name all those things that are out there in the media all the time, and there's no uniform way that we describe this. It's this abstract thing that's way off in the future, and unless we make it a marketable product for the public, they're not going to pay attention, and they're not going to support the billions and billions and billions of dollars it's going to take to address this issue. So it seems we've got to have uniform messages. There has to be a sustained way, not just for an individual agency. It's not just the Department of Water Resources, or it's not just the city of San Francisco. There has to be a much more sustained campaign that addresses these issues.
I think that's very true, and I will step out of the moderator's role just to mention a piece of work that we're doing in New York City right now with our mayor's sustainable plan, engaging, inviting residents of the city to think about problems. Two of the 10 problems are water-related. They're very focused on climate change, to come together and think over time about how to shape the city and what kinds of investments and hard decisions need to be made. And I think that this was the first outreach, which was a supplement in the New York Times and also I think in the Daily News, which I think is the most circulated paper in New York City, and will be followed by meetings with a variety, different groups being involved and getting bigger as time goes on. To try to engage in some of this thinking in a way where people are in at the early end, not just presented with a plan and expected to vote thumbs up or thumbs down on it. And I think the idea of putting together a sustained conversation about this with some consistent information is very important. And this in New York City doesn't preclude the water utilities thinking about climate change and water and the things that go along with that, and really trying to reach out nationally. One more, last one.
I'm Mark Rockwell. I'm here kind of representing the Endangered Species Coalition, which is a national organization that is made up of nearly 400 different environmental and business groups. And I guess my question is, after listening to yesterday, it revolves around the impacts of global warming on an ecosystem-wide basis rather than just a human impact basis.
I'm going to interrupt you, but I don't want to disappoint you, but we're not going to do questions, so I hope you'll be able to make this a comment.
Okay.
Thanks.
My comment is that I would encourage water managers and people who are involved in water planning to try to include the impacts that your decisions will have on other species other than Homo sapiens, to include that in the process early on rather than late in the game, which I think has occurred many times down through history, where water decision implications have negatively impacted species that we have to end up dealing with in very confrontational ways. So if we could get started in that in the early stages rather than the late stages, that would be good.
Thank you. I think we need to move on. I apologize. Let's take a few minutes thinking about legislative aspects, and I think that is local, state, and federal. And several times in conversations yesterday, I heard comments about the new Congress and how we can engage them. Certainly California, the local water authorities have a very lively relationship with their legislators, as do we in New York. So I would love to have some thoughts about that. And Chuck, I thought we might start with you.
Okay. I think there's a couple things, and it actually relates back to the public engagement issue. I mean, I thought about my city council sitting here yesterday, and luckily for me, one city council member is really a climate change geek. I mean, he's into this issue. He happens to be the chair of my subcommittee, so for him, it's real easy to sit down and have a conversation. But for many elected officials, whether they be legislative or city council or mayors or your boards or commissions that you report to, it's not a, if you want to sit down and have a day discussion with them over climate change, this isn't going to get very far. And I think the big issue for legislative engagement, public engagement, but particularly legislative engagement, is what are the consequences in simplistic terms? I know it's terrible to have to say that, but in fairly simple terms, what are the consequences to your system, to their electorate for climate change, and what can they do? I mean, can you give them something, an action that they can take to get some kind of political credit that doesn't have huge downsides? I mean, this is like it's a, you know, a strategy, like Lester talked about, a comprehensive strategy on public engagement. You ought to have the same strategy related to how to get legislative support for whatever programs you think are, need to go forward. I mean, I have great staff, as you all do, who, if you give them a task, can solve a problem. And so it's easy for me to do that. What I need is the authority, the legislative authority, to let them do their job. And so I think the challenge is, how do we really take all this complex stuff and distill it down to consequences that they can understand, consequences maybe short-term and long-term for them from a political election perspective and from a constituent perspective, so that really means something to them. And I think that's the challenge for this.
Thoughts from participants about things that you can get your legislators to do or things that you've tried in the back. Can we get a mic over there?
Hi, I'm Zach Bauer from Malcolm Perney. I think just in line with what everybody was saying is that all of us may not be, you know, so-called environmentalists in this room, but when you're having a conversation with someone who isn't totally on board with climate change, and if you really value and understand the implications of this, to be a warrior for it, to stand up and say something and don't be quiet and, you know, and really speak your mind and speak your voice and, you know, put forward what you think is real. And in time, things can change and minds can change and people can move on. But we have to, you know, don't be quiet about it and just keep pushing.
Thank you. Yes.
Claudia Turneden with the Water Environment Research Foundation out of Alexandria, Virginia. And what I would like to just add to this comment, to this point, is it addresses mostly legislative aspects, but also to some extent the public engagement, is that I think the most important thing that we could do in a short term in terms of communication and reaching out to legislative, we believe, is that the water industry speaks with one voice. I think it's very important, and when I say water, I mean the water and the wastewater side. I think it's very important that the message that I completely agree, it has to be clear, it has to be succinct, but at the same time, it needs to be one voice. Right now, we have echoes, and when we speak to Washington, there's an echo effect, and I think we need to make sure that that's real clear.
Thank you. Yes, also in the back.
Hi, Ted Howard of the California Public Utilities Commission. I was watching Barbara Boxer last night on the news, and they were another senator was asking, really claiming, because they were debating on the global warming, and they were saying, well, gee, you know, I think you're really just talking because it's profitable for all these green industries now. And I'm thinking, yeah, of course, that's what it needs to be. It needs to be profitable. And furthermore, it's really, you know, the oil industries, the fossil fuel industries that are making hundreds of times more profit. And although we don't like to admit it, often that's what drives it. So I think if we could internalize externalities, especially the great externality of dependence on Mideast oil and from other countries such as Venezuela and so on, regardless of your political leanings, if we could internalize that, because it, apparently that's what it would take to drive the point home to the public. A lot of people don't see the actual the profitability of it. If there's a profitability of it, they will pursue it a lot more. It's kind of like an inconvenient truthiness, where truthiness is the word, you know, the word of the year, which is arguing from your gut is my interpretation, rather than on basic facts. It's really just saying, well, because I have a vested interest here without saying so explicitly, this is my opinion. And unfortunately, that comes from a very high level in our administration as far as kind of covering up the truth and talking from what we want to be rather than what we really see. So that point and the externalities, I think, might be of use.
Thank you. If I could come back to a panelist now. Brad, if I could get your thoughts on that.
You know, I'm interested actually in the federal angles here. You know, what I see is this great opportunity that's going to arise in 2008. And I don't think it's realistic to expect we're going to get much federal leadership here until that point in time. I think it's actually pretty encouraging if you look at what you all do in the history of every major environmental legislative action in this country in the past. And I'll include Superfund, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act. All of those actions have had state analogs, every one of them. And the feds have stepped in at the end because people have said we can't have this quilt work of actions out there. And so what happens here and what happens in Oregon and Washington and New Mexico and Montana really do count. And I guess I would encourage all of you, you know, it's unbelievable to come here from Colorado or Nebraska. And, you know, we have straw coming out of our ears in some ways, and in other ways we're quite sophisticated. But you all are leading the pathway here, and I would just encourage all of you to continue forward with what you're doing here and to not get discouraged, because we are going to get leadership in 2008. It's very clear when you look at the presidential field out there on both sides of the aisle that whoever wins this is going to act on it. So those are my comments on the federal legislative side, which is a little more inclusive than that.
Yes, one more. All right, two more. The one where the mic is now and then someone farther to the front.
Jim Graydon, Kennedy Jenks Consultants. This is bridging, I think, legislative and regulatory, but I think from California's standpoint, the low-hanging fruit here is to make sure that the rules that are being written, the regulations that are being written as to how we're going to establish eligibility criteria and prioritization ranking for the infrastructure bonds that were just passed, some $37 billion, and the infrastructure bonds are being proposed, is a real opportunity to make sure that these considerations are included. Were considerations such as that included in the water bond established, state water project, we might have some different outcomes at this time.
Thank you. And one more up front. Third table. Okay, thank you.
I'm John Rosenblum from the Sonoma County Climate Protection Campaign. One thing about the legislative aspects is politics. And maybe, you know, this meeting is a little bit too genteel in that we think if we propose some rational ideas that things will happen. I was just looking at Lester Snow's budget. $4.5 billion for reservoirs, only $0.2 billion for something called efficiency or conservation. And that's politics. So it's, and the same applies to public engagement. It's messy. And we can't possibly expect to have a polite meeting all through and not have to deal with the opportunism, the rudeness, and everything else.
I think that's certainly true, although I'm not sure that the participants are incapable of dealing with that. They don't look to me like they would probably be steamrollered over by a little rough interaction. Maybe we can see later. We had one more over here, and then I'm going to go on to the next topic.
My name is Doug Wallace with East Bay Municipal Utility District. I'm happy to be a little bit impolite. Speaking of federal leadership and straw in the ears and so forth, one of the things that gets me is the subsidies for corn-based ethanol. And so we need to help our legislators understand what is a dead-end direction to be taking in terms of negative impacts from these so-called solutions. and generate true solutions that actually reduce the carbon footprint.
Thank you. I think we can bridge to regulatory fairly easily at that point. And I was going to ask Jeff to comment on regulatory issues and how they assist or impede your addressing some of these issues.
Thank you, Emily. One of the topics I think about when I think of the regulatory aspects is people have raised it here. We are trying to do what we call integrated regional water management planning in California, but it's very difficult because it's very foreign, and we're only doing it on the water aspects where we're trying to incorporate for the first time sort of the pure water use as well as sewer and flood control. And we don't do that very well. Most of it is split up by political boundaries. I'm lucky in some respects to run a regional agency, but we don't have many regional agencies in California. And then my agency overlies a whole host of flood control areas, water basin managers, sewer projects, and different projects. And we're trying to coordinate with all of them on integrated regional projects. And then we have no input whatsoever pretty much into the land use planning other than commenting, which is a whole host of other cities and counties that run land use. And so we are not very well coordinated in terms of our planning. And I think that's a tremendous drawback, and I think it's a good effort that we are trying to do more regional planning in terms of water resources, but we're at a very early stage on that. And that does perhaps tie back into the legislative aspect, but it is a local land use regulation, and all that on sewers, water supply, we have very little coordination, and we try and make it work, but it's very difficult.
I think one of the things that's so interesting about regulatory issues is that as water management agencies, we deal with a tremendous amount of regulation coming from a lot of different places, and it can be extraordinarily time-consuming, and sometimes it can lead you into positions where you may, in order to accomplish one regulation, you may start to go out of compliance with another regulation. And so, in my mind, having ways to cut through this and having a way to bring regulators together to understand some of these issues and perhaps really try to help with them rather than becoming something that keeps us tied up very aggressively every day and makes it more difficult to step back and think in a more strategic way about larger climate change issues is going to be a very important part of our being effective, and it's one of the hopes I bring to this group is that there will be insights in ways to doing that, that perhaps there'll be there will be a county or a state or a city that is doing it very effectively, and that we can then take that as a template to our own environment and advocate that. So I would love to hear more from you about regulatory and legislative issues and how they are, I guess, the legislative, regulatory, and planning issues tend to cluster together. So if you have things that you've done that have been helpful or strategies that you're thinking of trying or things that you would like to have help with where you feel your regulators are impeding your addressing important climate change issues, you can speak now, which I would very much appreciate, or you can write to the website as you think about a little farther. But is there anyone today who could speak? Yes. Can we get a mic up front?
This gentleman.
Good.
Hi, I'm Will Travis, Executive Director of the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, or if you watch CNN, I'm Travis Mills, but that's okay. As a regulator, I think it's important in listening to the rhetoric of cutting through regulations and streamlining them. I think it's important to remember that those regulations were all put in place in reaction to some abuse, and that they are advancing very legitimate and enlightened public policy. And what you may see as an impediment is really a regulation that is put there to protect environmental resources. some people commented on my remarks yesterday that I talked entirely about the economy and nothing about the environment, even though we are seen as an environmental protection agency. It seems to me that just as this conference has opened a dialogue between the water agencies and the environmental communities, I think what we need to be doing is finding our own worst enemy and going and sitting down and seeing where we have common ground, and then putting together a coalition of allies that are not normally working together, and then going to the legislature and asking to have legislative oversight hearings on everything from the Port of Cologne Act to the laws that protect San Francisco Bay to the laws that deal with air quality and water quality and so forth, and looking for a systemic approach. The reason I suggest that is I have found that the last election did a fabulous job of making the San Francisco Chronicle fun to read, because I would get up every day before the election and go to page 2 and see what goofy thing Congress had done, and now I go and find an enlightened thing that they're doing. So I think that we have an opportunity here to work together, to work with our legislative leaders in a bipartisan fashion to address this problem from what we're facing in the future, instead of all of the laws that we have put in place to deal with problems of the past.
Yes.
Dave Nesmith with the Environmental Water Caucus. One of the things that was identified yesterday as a real opportunity that I think needs to be highlighted is the fact that there is a tremendous resource in conjunctive use groundwater management. California is one of only two states in the country that does not regulate or measure groundwater. And I think it's an outrageous gap that needs to be filled.
Thank you.
Matt Vanderslice from the Planning and Conservation League. I was having breakfast recently with Tim Quinn of the Metropolitan, and he was telling a story that he's using as he talks to his board about some issues, and it's talking about when the Clean Water Act was passed, and he needed to go to his board and simply explain that, look, the rules are different now, and we need to figure out how to work with those new rules. And that we're back in a place like that. He used the metaphor for a different story, but we're back in a similar situation with AB 32, the Global Warming Solutions Act, where the rules are going to substantially change, and one of the primary components of that is looking very specifically at what are our emissions across the state, what are our baseline conditions, all of those sorts of things. And so as we come up with messages that we bring to the public, I think one of the ways that the public will, if they see that we're really making a good faith effort and not just having a marketing campaign. So I think if water managers, along with others, can come together and urge new regulations that help us actually quantify our water use and quantify our savings in a verifiable way, the public is going to respond and say, it really looks like you all are making the effort. I can clearly see through the numbers that it's happening. And I think one of the primary components of that will also be moving past talking about conservation as demand hardening, and instead talking about conservation as creating a new demand. And I was fascinated to talk with Chuck Clark yesterday with his chart of all of those demand predictions. A couple of years go by and a new demand prediction comes out that's radically different from the old one. A couple of years go by, a new demand prediction that's radically different from the old one. Mm-hmm. It never gets hard. It just keeps changing.
Very interesting. David.
Yes, I'd just like to perhaps echo those last few thoughts on the floor. Certainly our experience in the UK has been that you cannot move forward significantly at all to try and address some of the challenges we face in an integrated way without engaging properly between the utility companies and the regulators. It's absolutely essential, and it does take time and effort. It hasn't been something that's been natural for us in the UK. We have had to spend a lot of time building trust between the regulatory agencies and the utility companies. But when we've achieved that, it's been enormously helpful. And it has achieved that feedback loop, which is very important, back into the legislative process. Because when you get a collective bodies working together, it is actually very much easier to influence the legislative process.
Chuck.
Yeah, maybe one comment. And I'm going to go back to running two state environmental agencies and a regional office of EPA and be a regulator again for a second and tell you what I hated. What I hated is when people came in and said they didn't like prescriptive rules, they didn't like the rules of the way they're written, they really wanted a performance-based standard, and when I asked them what they meant, they said, well, you just need to trust us, because we're green or we know what we want to do. If, however, somebody came in and said, we don't like the prescriptive standards, we've done a lot of modeling or monitoring and a lot of work, we've run some demonstration projects, we can show you results, and we can invest better to have a better return for the environment and prove it, I found the regulator pretty open to looking at those issues. And so, I mean, I think as we look at kind of regulatory engagement in this issue, I think what we need to do with regulators is bring to them solutions. I spend more on training for my staff probably in a month than most of the regulators in our state spend in a year. I mean, I've got staff going everywhere, and I have much better resources than the regulator does. So what we're striving to do is take them solutions, and what I'm finding is they're very open to those as long as we can prove what we're doing and that it has a positive benefit.
Good, thank you.
Over here, I've got the answer. Which is,
thank goodness.
Which is the words that nobody wants to hear, which are taxes and caps. So we've seen this, you know, sort of play out in our local general plan process. It seems really clear to everybody who's involved with the general plan updates and so forth that there need to be metrics. There need to be numbers like here's the baseline for water use, per capita water use. Here's the baseline for per capita wastewater production. We need to cap this, and we need to start reducing. You know, those kinds of metrics and numbers and caps and stuff like that are evident to everybody, but we don't have the leadership right now to step up and say, here's what's necessary. Same is true of taxes. We need a carbon tax. We need fees on higher energy use. We've got to start changing that behavior in order to start reducing emissions. So those are the two, you know, the sledgehammers that right now nobody wants to go there, but I think we need to.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm Nancy Price with the Alliance for Democracy. There's a lot of eagerness for flexible and innovative regulatory legislative planning tools, but one thing that concerns me greatly is that the federal government has committed states and communities to a free trade regime that is inflexible and not innovative. And I think that with these issues of water planning, both water services and water resources, that there must be a careful examination of how the General Agreement on Trade and Services under the WTO will greatly affect state and local planning on these issues, and particular land use planning, which is not thought to be impacted perhaps by GATS or WTO or the other trade agreements. But I think it's essential in looking at legislative and regulatory issues to really examine the impact of the trade agreements on the ability to be flexible and innovative and act in timely ways that the trade agreements actually don't allow.
Thank you. One more, yes.
Hi, I'm Dave Monti with King County up in the Seattle area. We're not a water supplier, but we are a regional government that has a lot of responsibilities with regard to land use, stormwater control, flood management. We operate the regional wastewater system and do a lot of other things where we expect there will be a lot of changes due to climate change that we'll have to anticipate. And picking up on your comment about a template, the County Council has asked us to develop an annual climate plan, the first of which is due today. I think it may be delayed by a week or so is what I've heard. But what we have done is we've put together an intra-agency group within the county to identify potential impacts to all the different activities we engage in, which range across planning, permitting, regulatory, as well as some of the things like actually acquiring assets, like purchasing hybrid buses or biodiesel buses for our transportation system. And I think what's going to happen, this is an annual report that we're going to have to be doing. We are going to be imposing performance measures on ourselves. We're going to be reporting how much progress we're making. And I think it's going to result in some dialogue that'll be going both up and down, because we're going to be having to talk to state regulatory agencies about the issue that Chuck was just talking about, where we're either not getting the support or the freedom to do things we think we need to do. But it's also going to be generating some discussion within the county itself and staff who probably at this point don't really see what the impacts of climate change are on their programs. For the moment, this process is supposed to go on indefinitely. I don't know if it really will go on indefinitely, but I think what it's going to do is force a lot of people to confront some issues that need to be discussed and generate some ideas and some pathways that I think people hadn't thought of before. But I'll send some more information about it to the website, but just in terms of an initial getting the discussion going and thinking of impacts and how to address them, that's one thing we're going to be doing in King County.
Thank you. I think ideas like that about natural forums for engaging in some of these discussions are very helpful. I'd like to move now to planning issues. We talked a fair amount about those yesterday. I thought there were lots of really rich opportunities, because this is where I think the lack of definitiveness of some of the science makes it difficult for the planners to move from planning into deciding to invest money in programs or infrastructure. And so I'm hoping there will be some discussion about how to plan, even as we're collecting the data, in a way that gives our investors, our mayors, whoever it is, whose support we need in our authorizing environment, confidence to let us move ahead with some choices that may be important to get going on, but for which the science may not yet be exact. Or maybe Peter will tell me that it is exact. There's more than enough already. So on planning, I do want to start by asking Peter to talk about that a little bit.
Thank you. What I'd like to do is maybe offer five specific suggestions and maybe describe one case study that I think is informative. And before I do, the question at the beginning from the guy from the water agency who was looking for a definitive statement, we sort of put that off, but I did want to just offer the following. And I mentioned this document yesterday. This is 1997, the American Water Works Association Committee Report on Climate Change and Water Resources. And it's a four-page thing. It's not very long. But the subtitle, maybe this would be helpful to you, from 10 years ago, is, quote, "Global warming is a fact, and water resource managers need to plan accordingly." That seemed pretty clear to me. I like that. And
sometimes
I'd be happy to
timing is everything.
I'd be happy to share this with anybody who wants to share that with their constituents. But okay, so the five suggestions for planning I originally wrote these, and the first couple started, no something, and I figured that's not the right way to start it, so I'm going to turn it around. All new water-related infrastructure shall be designed and built incorporating expected climate change over the life of the project. If you're building something that's going to last 20 years or 40 years or 100 years, you have to design it and build it incorporating climate change. All projections of water demand, and every water agency makes them, all projections of water demand shall include the effects of climate change. All water management decisions must take into account the energy implications and greenhouse gas emission implications of those decisions. Some of this gets to some of the comments earlier about caps and credits. Water agencies, if they get credit for their greenhouse gas reductions, are going to look for them. The state of California has set a goal, a target for greenhouse gas emissions reductions. If your water agency can find those reductions, which admittedly will mostly be through some energy-related aspect of your system, and get credit for it, maybe even, I don't know, money somehow, then that certainly helps the planning process. Existing water systems shall be tested under conditions of future climate change. And again, we had examples of this yesterday. Chuck gave some examples that Seattle has done. Test your existing system under a different set of assumptions, climate assumptions, than we're used to. The last one is water agencies shall partner with other agencies and authorities to seek combined solutions. Sometimes the best solutions are not purely water solutions, but they're a combination of water and energy solutions, or water and wastewater solutions, or wastewater and transportation solutions. I mean, and we heard a little bit about this again, but it should be fundamental upfront in planning. And this leads to my quick case study. The state of California passed some legislation, and it gets to the legislative regulatory side of this too, passed a law a couple of years ago, setting a new standard for front load, the efficiency, the water efficiency of front loading washing machines. Now, because of the way the federal government looks at state standards, in order for the state to do that, we have to apply for a waiver, an exemption from federal authority to set these standards. And there is no federal water efficiency standard for front-loading washing machines. So we passed the law. We applied for the waiver. It was the law was supposed to go into effect January 1. On December 28th, 3 days before our law was supposed to go into effect, the Department of Energy rejected, it was a Friday afternoon, of course, rejected the state of California's application for a waiver. So our efficiency standard for front-loading washing machines is not going into effect. And I know that Guido is here, and I know this isn't necessarily his responsibility, but the Energy Commission does have the ability to apply for
waiver?
An appeal. Thank you. A little senior moment there. And I hope that they do so. But the water savings from front-loading washing machines are combined with the energy savings from front-loading washing machines to make them cost-effective. If you just look at how much water you save and the value of the water given the pricing structure for water, often it's not necessarily cost-effective because of the additional cost of front-loading washing machines. But if you look at the energy savings as well, they're hugely cost-effective. So, from a water utility's point of view, it's hard for them maybe by themselves to push front-loading washing machines. But for a water utility and an energy utility together, there are net societal benefits, and certainly economic benefits to the consumer and greenhouse gas emission benefits that we don't even quantify economically. And so it's an example where combined efforts of multiple agencies, combined efforts of state and federal, combined regulatory and legislative things come together to identify solutions, but unfortunately solutions we've not yet necessarily been able to put into effect as effectively as I think we could.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the floor for a few comments.
I'd like to jump in as a comment from the floor.
You may.
The points that Peter made were, I think, very good ones. And whether it's those planning issues or those possible solutions, whether it's trying to get our land use departments of our various counties to pay attention under the regulatory or under the legislative aspect, to maybe take somebody even mentioned taxes, to make those tough choices, whether they're solutions that Peter made or possibly some fees or taxes raised to support these efforts, because some of these solutions may be, even though initially they may be, or in the long run will definitely pay off, initially they're gonna mean some action, some heavy lifting by our colleagues and heavy lifting by our different elected leaders. And to get that done, I believe, it goes back to the point of public engagement. And so what I'd like to do right now is to say, let's follow up on the comment that Lester Snow made about let's get a communications plan going. And one of the things to kick that off today, I'd like to say that the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission would be willing to pledge $100,000. I have one of my commissioners sitting here, so she has given me the thumbs up, so at least I've got one vote out of five on that, but I think we can get a unanimous support of that. To get $100,000 from our agency, and what I'd like to do is to see any other West Coast agencies, and if we can get a whole East Coast consortium, it would be great too, Emily. But for us on the West Coast, for sure California, Oregon, Washington, possibly even Arizona and Colorado, is to the major agencies, each of us pledge $100,000 to this public outreach to educate people about how climate change will affect one of our most precious resources, drinking water, and how it will affect, of course, as well, the potential of wastewater. So real vital things to people's lives to educate them. So we're willing to pledge $100,000. I think all other major agencies, larger agencies, should pledge $100,000. I know everybody likes to think of themselves as the big kids as opposed to little kids. But smaller agencies could pledge $50,000. And then what would be great, Lester, is for the state, DWR, to match the collection of the different agencies. And we are willing to volunteer. Okay, all right. Let's see.
Starting.
And we are willing to volunteer. Our staff, the San Francisco PUC, is willing to be the group that convenes the different communications heads. All of you have public relations people or the head of external affairs or director of communications, and we'd be willing to pull together that committee of different communications heads of the different agencies to see about getting and engaging a public outreach on this, because if any of us are going to do some heavy lifting around this, whether it's planning, whether it's regulatory, whether it's legislative, we've got to get the public to buy in and say, yeah, that's the right thing, that's the right way to spend our money, that's, yes, I will make that tough decision around conservation. So I'll get off my soapbox now, but I hope you all join me, and I want everybody, you know, emailing in saying they're in. So thank you.
Susan, I would urge you to include what they can do about it as well, not just how serious an issue it is, but all of the great things people can do, because people are looking for that. And I'm sure you meant that, but I just wanted to add it.
We have one response here, and then we'll go to the floor.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow the very important point about educating the public, because two of the questions which inevitably will come up then is, what is the scale of the problem we face and what might be done about it? And I was taken with Peter's point, which I thought was a very important one, which was to do with testing our existing systems with respect to climate change. What might that mean in terms of their performance? And when developing new systems to account for climate change over the lifetime of the system. And even if we only do that on pilot or demonstration areas, we would at least begin to have a handle on what this means and to try and quantify objectively the scale of the problem. Mm-hmm. Because it's hugely important in engaging with the public that we actually are able to give them those answers. And to give them those answers, we need to collect those facts.
Thank you. Yes.
Yes, I just want to. I'm Joel Smith, and I just want to pick up on Peter's points, which I agree with, and I think I'm very impressed with this workshop that there's been a lot of bottom-up effort by major utilities to address the risks from climate change. It sort of begs the question of whether this ought to be required. Should all utilities, utilities above a certain size, other water agencies be required to look at the implications of climate change over 30, 50, whatever the appropriate planning horizon is, consider it, then begin to look at the things I think that Peter is talking about. In Britain, and David, correct me if I'm wrong, the water utilities are supposed to look at they're required to look at their long-term planning and show that they are robust against a specified set of climate change scenarios. I'm not sure I'd go that far, but I think it clearly is a requirement that, as I understand, is starting to make water managers look very seriously at this. So I throw that out as a possibility.
Thank you.
Ellen Burns with MWH. And I'm encouraged and increasingly excited. MWH has asked me to lead our climate change commitment for 2007. And people keep asking the same things that you are. What do we do? What are we doing? Is this real? And to follow up on a few things, kind of synthesize a little, I really like Peter's comments. But one of the most things we do when we're talking to more and more people is seeing a transition from a world where we were very internally focused on what we were doing and meeting a regulatory world. And now we're being asked to be more creative and look external and further from just the small boundaries of our community or agency and where do we fit. And so some of the ways that we're helping and thinking about moving things forward is saying, well, here's the set of things we have to do to meet the current set of regulatory conditions. How do we, understanding that climate change is pervasive and crosses the small silos of our agencies and states and federal organizations, how do we use this world today in our CIP planning to meet these regulatory boxes, but to create platforms and places to leverage the real actions that we see coming down in years 3, 5, and 10 and the legacies we're putting together?
Thank you. Yes.
One of the things that we've noticed in our community climate action plan development is that the greenhouse gas emissions reduction metric is a pretty key integrator for integrating a lot of different activities. And so we've kind of adopted this approach of, we've adopted the UNFCCC mission statement in a way, which is stabilization of atmospheric CO2. And this came up yesterday. And we're really looking at this process as being what we're involved in here is stabilizing atmospheric CO2. What needs to be done in order to do this? And so we have to look 50 years ahead. We have to say, okay, over the next 50 years, we're going to have to stop using fossil fuels. So this is the transition that we're involved in. So as a planning tool, we find this to be very helpful as a motivator and a driver to motivate planning, is looking out to the time, which will be soon, when we will have to have stopped using fossil fuels in order to stabilize atmospheric CO2.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, Bruce McGurk with the SFPUC, Hetch Hetchy Water and Power. Two comments. One was Ms. Leal's comment that with a plan and to contact people and reach out, we've got a new opportunity. People are tired of hearing about energy efficiency, water conservation. We've all been doing that as agencies distributing water for a long time. Global warming and climate change, as it now reaches out to people, is a new way to
to remind people why, when they save some water, they're saving energy, they're saving all kinds of things, as well as improving their future. So the global warming story is a new way to get at a lot of the themes that we've been talking about for years. So it's a huge opportunity. The second question, we've got a little bit of a disparity. Yesterday and then again this morning, we heard that what shouldn't be done is base decisions on the past. That's not quite right. Dan Kahan showed a wonderful plot yesterday of global warming and CO2 with and without global warming. There was the Earth's future without and with. We have to have the past as part of our story to show how the change occurs. As a hydrologist, we can't do hydrologic studies without the past. What we're really meaning to say is we need to remember to include the effect of global warming when we design studies, and not, as some people have pointed out, design things ignoring the new changing future. But the past has got to be there. It provides all of the background on which we build and design and project demand.
Lester, I think you were one of the people that talked a little bit about that, thinking about the future. Maybe you'd like to clarify that a little bit.
Well, let me start in a slightly different way, but I think it's how we get to integrating these. I mean, on the issue of planning, a number of people touched on this. We have to have integrated planning. There's too many silos for planning. And one sore point with us is getting land use agencies to integrate flood risk into their land use decisions. I mean, that's a simple example. But the concern I have of where we're trying to go is we don't have adequate tools out there right now. We do not have, in my opinion, uniform assessments of carbon footprints. I mean, I don't think there's a uniform way to compare one agency to another and make sure you're comparing apples to oranges. And it's a lot more complex than it seems on the surface. And also, we've got these climate models on a kind of a big scale. And to make it meaningful to a water, wastewater entity, flood entity, you've got to bring it down to an operations model. You know, exactly what's going to happen in the stream system. And we still haven't done that. As we speak, we've got modelers working on that, but we don't have those standardized methods. And so I think the key, while you're still developing those methods, is to do future scenarios. You don't have a single plot that you're planning to. You actually develop several alternatives of what you can expect from climate change. And that's one of the challenges with the communication strategy, is that you show the public one of those spaghetti diagrams, and they're flipping the channel. They're not going to sit there for that when you tell them you're going to spend $1 billion because of those squiggly lines. And if I could go back to that point a moment, I think the whole communications effort starts off like a campaign, meaning polling and focus groups to find out what phrases people respond to. If it turns out people flip the channel when you say global warming, don't say it again. I mean, I think if this is a campaign to achieve something, then don't be worried about throwing away your favorite phrase or your favorite way of talking about this. If we want to be effective, then let's do it just like a campaign.
Yes.
Just responding to something that I just heard Lester talk about, one of the challenges that we all face is that level of uncertainty in the knowledge and how we do accordingly. One of the things my agency started doing 3 years ago in our integrated resource planning was building into what we just called a buffer. And we are doing about 10% extra in every category of conservation, recycling, reclamation. Each of those programs, we build into it a planning buffer, and we call it for project uncertainty. You know, very often projects don't come online at the pace you want, and we understand this is an added cost to our ratepayers, and it costs more to do this, but we believe we need that uncertainty buffer. And that fits into the whole climate change, because we're not exactly sure how it's going to play out in terms of climate change, in terms of water supply reliability. We do know it's likely to be negative, and therefore that buffer helps us get to where we want to be at 2025 and 2030. And the only other comment I'd make is I have a chairman of the board here. I've got 37 board members, but he gave me a thumbs up at Susan's offer. So at least you've got one vote.
Jeff. Yeah. Jeff, just a quick follow-up. Do you identify that planning buffer to the public?
Yes, we do. And we have a chart that shows growth, demand, needs, and then we have a 10% planning buffer on it and what it costs. And so it basically broadens our band that we're working on.
Great. And now Peter has...
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing. There are uncertainties, but not everything is uncertain, and not everything is equally uncertain. In addition, you, water agencies, spend money, sometimes a lot of money, in the face of uncertainty. I'm a customer of the East Bay Municipal Utilities District, Doug, which has just spent $250 million, $300 million, a huge amount of money, on earthquake retrofit. Now, we don't know how big the earthquake is going to be. We don't know when it's going to be, even in the lifespan of the infrastructure. But the utility decided it was vulnerable enough to be willing to spend real money and to be willing to explain it to the customers. Not only are they spending it, and not only did they have a pretty good public relations campaign saying why they're spending it, but on my bill, I have an explicit seismic retrofit charge. It's not hidden in the fee. It's not hidden in the wastewater fee or the water tariff. It's explicit. And so water utilities can do this when they want, and they can be very good at it. And I'm happy to pay that fee.
Yes. All right. From the floor?
I'm Cheryl Davis, also from San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. And building on the prior comments, I think we do need more knowledge and that utilities can learn from each other, not only about how to adapt to global warming, but what our alternatives are for minimizing our contribution to it. And I would just cite two examples is the city of Petaluma, and looking at their wastewater and recycling alternatives, did ecological footprint analysis, looking at the fuel and chemical costs that would be associated with different ways of treating that water. And Yarra Valley Water in Australia has done really sophisticated analysis where when they're contemplating a construction project, they're evaluating alternatives in terms of the possible greenhouse emission effects associated with the actual creation of the building materials that they will later be putting into the ground. So I'm thinking that AWARF or some other utility research group might be able to help us by looking and doing research on people who have been pioneers in that aspect.
Berkeley National Laboratory. I want to make a couple comments with regard to uncertainties and floods and droughts, which I think there's a lot of confusion here. One thing important to know, I've been part of the climate change studies for over 10, 15 years now with Guido and other people, as well as the IPCC. Our understanding of floods in the future, regardless of all these outcomes that Dan showed yesterday, we're going to see high flow occurrences that are going to be much higher than we've seen before under what we call the future dry, cool, relatively cool scenarios, the relatively warmer, wet scenarios. So these things are going to occur. They're going to occur much higher than we know now, regardless. As far as droughts go, and Lester doesn't even know this, we're working very closely with the hydrology branch under Francis Chung, and we've been using C2V-SIM, the California Central Valley Simulation Model, doing relative sensitivity studies of all kinds of drought scenarios and how we're going to switch our water from surface flow to groundwater flow, how this is going to drop, how wells are going to be requiring much more electricity, and things are going to shift if we don't take these kinds of things into account, which are based on our understanding of the paleoclimate. We live in a slightly wetter regime than we have in the past. We've had these very, very long mega droughts in the past, and under natural variability, there's no reason to think that this isn't going to occur again. There are a lot of other things I could say, but I'm just going to leave it short and maybe talk more during the technical part.
Thank you. All right, it is now break time. We will have about 12 minutes, and then we will come back and we will move on to the technical and engineering, but there will be time at the end to revisit all of the topics, the thoughts that you'd like to pursue. So please be back in 12 minutes. Thank you. A participant in the panel. If you see a panelist, take that person by the arm, please, and escort him in this direction. I would like to say, apropos of what we've been talking about in terms of being clear about what you need, four very nice people brought me chocolate muffins. So there's a lot to be said for being clear. I'm going to try to do it more frequently in my life in the future. All right, so now we are going to talk about technical and engineering issues. Again, what are specific things that people have tried? What kinds of things are under consideration? And then we're going to open it up more broadly, because obviously all of these categories are somewhat artificial. We've tried to use it to give it a little focus, but they touch on each other in many, many ways, and in some ways that's the richest part of the conversation. So we will spend probably about 20 minutes on the technical and engineering, and then go to this broader discussion. So I'm going to start off by asking David to make some comments about some technical strategies and engineering strategies that he's been familiar with in the UK.
Thank you, Emily. Perhaps just under a number of headings then, and if we start with the actual issues of climate change itself, I think it's been extremely illuminating over the last couple of days to see all the extensive work that's going on to help us get a better understanding of climate change and climate change impacts. It does have a downside, however, because all the different organisations working on this, with the best of intentions, will produce different views of what the future might look like. And we've talked about uncertainty, and there is a lot of uncertainty in our vision of the future. It's not actually awfully helpful, however, to utilities who have to produce practical solutions and have to interpret that on a day-to-day basis. And one of the things that can help enormously, and I hope we might consider to take forward as an action from here, is to try and get some consensus between the various agencies working in our sector as to what climate change might really look like in the future and what the boundaries might be on future uncertainty. Because unless we have a consensus view, it's very easy for critics to unpick the arguments, and that can then be a real barrier to taking measures forward. So I think the first thing I would like to see come out of here is some action which helps to address the issue of bringing together all the different relevant collective views on climate change and trying to distill it into something which is useful for utility companies and other stakeholders to work with. So that will be my first point. My second point really is to talk a little bit about developing solutions in a scenario of uncertainty. And I think one of the points I picked up from the various documents that have been around over the last couple of days is the concept of no regrets. And that's certainly a philosophy which we've used, I think, with considerable effect in the UK, and I know has been used over here as well. And this is taking an incremental approach, not trying to start with solutions today that will answer all the questions of the future, but really to say, what do we need to do now which is going to take us in the right direction for the next 10 or 20 years, and which in 20 years' time we won't have to stand up and say, actually, we shouldn't have done that. We should have done something different. Or, even worse, I wish we'd acted 20 years ago. I think Peter made the point about the statements put out in 1997. Maybe some of us are thinking if only we'd started to act in 1997, some of the problems might not have been quite so challenging in 2007. So an incremental no regrets approach might be something which we want to think about as a strategy for taking things forward. We've talked about, from the third perspective, the importance of stakeholder engagement. And it does take time to bring the different stakeholders around the tables. And there are techniques to help get stakeholders to work together, to reconcile differences, to manage conflict, to move towards agreed ways forward. We do have to find the time in our planning process to bring those different agencies together, and that needs, of course, to include the engagement of the public, which we talked about. And that needs to be structured into our processes. We need that time, and the investment that's needed to do that needs to be in place. And I was delighted to hear Susan actually throw down the gauntlet, I think, about investing in that this morning, and I think that was very positive. And for the fourth point, when you start to get agencies around the table to look at the challenges we have to face and to think about how we might take things forward, there is a great opportunity for us to think much more laterally about how we might deal with our solutions in the future, how we might take on board the issues of our carbon footprints, of sustainable solutions, to maximise what we already have in terms of our existing assets. One of the ways in which you can help to manage emissions and deal with carbon issues is actually to make the maximum use of your existing assets so that you're not having to use resources to develop new assets. And that often means that you're going to devise solutions which are non-traditional solutions. And one of the problems we have as engineers is that we always like to take pride in building large things. Yeah, we like to stand by and we like to show our kids, I designed that, I built that. Maybe we need in the future to be proud of what we didn't build. So I'll leave it there.
Thank you. Comments from the floor about the technical engineering, if there are those, and then if not, we will go to the more general discussion. Yes, one in the back.
Thank you. I'm Mike Sheberl with Seawell Global. I'm in the private sector, and one of the things I've known about private sector is if you turned this room into the private sector, you'd have billions of dollars worth of captains of industry sitting in this room. Now, as captains of industry, if I recognized a problem, which we have all recognized, it's going to get warmer, there's going to be effects. That would then be a goal that I would task a group of these captains of industry who have a tremendous amount of assets at their disposal to solve that problem, or at least come up with recommendations to address that goal. I see in this room individual municipalities that are all trying to work together to a common goal. And if you put together a task force, in my opinion, to deal with this common goal and brought it back to your individual municipalities, then you would be solving one of the issues that was brought up earlier, which is speaking in one voice. Speaking as a group of people, and all of you are aware of one of the organizations that you work with that has a tremendous lobbying capability in Washington, and that's the American Water Works Association. That's essentially one voice for you people in your materials, in your engineering and design. I propose putting together some sort of task force like that, utilizing the tremendous amount of capability that I see in this room to address this goal, and then come back to this forum instead of attacking it as individual utilities, trying to address it as one recognized group with a leader. We need leadership in this, and I think the only way it's going to get accomplished is with a task force that has direction, where all this information can be disseminated into one spot, some recommendations can be put forth and brought back to this group and brought back to the public, brought back to the legislators as a combined effort through a recognized entity.
or a recognized group of people where all this information can come together. If this task was given to the private sector, they're in the business of making money. And so there would come up with a solution, and as David said, it may not be the perfect solution, but it would be a solution, and it would be a direction that you could, a path in which you could start to move forward to solve this issue on a regional basis and eventually a global basis.
Thank you, and that's an interesting way of going about this to consider. Thanks.
Hello. My name is Costa Georgiakakos. I come from San Diego. It's the Hydrologic Research Center. It's a non-profit technology transfer and training corporation. Most recently, we've been involved with several agencies in Northern California trying to increase water efficiency of the largest reservoirs there. Out of this project, which was a demonstration project, the INFORM project, I think there are some lessons that might be relevant for what we're talking about here. And I'd like to make three points. The first point pertains to the issue of uncertainty. There is an issue, there are two issues there. The first is characterizing the uncertainty, and that means uncertainty in our large-scale models, in downscaling, but also in demand, population growth, other such areas. And the second issue with respect to uncertainty is communicating uncertainty. And I think that should not be underestimated, because I think that will make for an effective public engagement and an effective regulatory engagement and others. Now, there is a need for improvement in our tools in this area. And I wanted to bring that up in the sense that there is some research and further development that needs to be done in that, engaging the university community and other research organizations. But I think we gain much out of such improvement. The second point pertains to the development of pilot projects. I think it was mentioned before. I want to again highlight it, in that I think it's an effective means of demonstrating that something can happen, and those are most effective if they involve participatory decision making. We talked about that, I think, in various terms in this meeting, but also adaptive and incremental decision making given the uncertainty. Again, that was discussed here. I just want to highlight it. Lastly, I think the issue of comparative studies should not be underestimated, because, as we mentioned before, looking at the past compared to the future, or what we believe the future is, again, looking at cases where you do something about potential climatic change versus cases you don't do something about it, I think, again, would provide ammunition for effective communication to the public and the regulation process.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes.
I'm Maury Roos, with the hydrologist with the Department of Water Resources. A couple of points. One is, and Larry Wilson sort of alluded to this too, I think it's very important to keep on monitoring what is happening for two reasons. The projection of trends is a good way to at least get a handle on something. And also, the feedback can go to the climate modelers, and they can refine and adapt their models if need be. That points more toward a 50-year horizon, maybe, is a reasonable projection to make. It's nice to know what they show for 100 years, but that's really pretty well beyond most of our planning endeavors. And there is a climate reference network that the NOAA was trying to set up in this country, originally for 300 stations. Now it's been scaled back to about 100. I think the Energy Commission helped get another one in California. which is locating measuring sites where we do not expect any changes in the land use in the vicinity, really trying to refine some of what really is happening. The next one is maybe a little bit far out, but we're talking billions, you know, and for that kind of money, maybe we ought to look or support the idea of looking at something out in space, just like putting mirrors out there, you know, something that can be taken down if necessary, but, you know, to try to reflect some energy back into space that we're not getting.
All right. Thank you. Brad had a comment.
Yeah, thanks. This whole question of data, I think, needs a very close look by the water management community. When you begin to take the wrappers off some of this data, you really see it has lots of warts on it. And let me talk about the NRCS snowtell data in the West. I know you all have your own system here. NRCS spends about $10 million on their system for the West. And I saw a very persuasive presentation by the snow surveyor in Salt Lake City, a guy by the name of Randy Julander, who's quite cantankerous and probably is properly called a curmudgeon. His presentation to the Upper Colorado River Commission showed just how much has gone on around these sites, changes in instrumentation from stainless steel pillows that have 10 gallons of fluid and are shiny to black Hypalon pillows that have 160 gallons. Weather modification efforts going on nearby, vegetational changes. The lesson here, I think, in general, and this applies to USGS and National Weather Service data as well, is we need to make sure these observing networks are in good enough shape to make decisions. They really don't cost that much money. They're not sexy. But I think you all need to be aware that the data that's out there is quite flawed, and we need to take care of it and make sure in the future it's doing what we need for us. And let me mention one other thing, kind of expand this to a larger level. There is a very nasty fight going on about the future of some satellites right now. And the fight involves these climate sensors on these very expensive satellites, and certain entities inside the federal government want to toss them off the satellites in favor of weather sensors. Weather is important, but climate also is really important. This affects all of us. No data means no good research, fundamentally. And I would encourage you all not to lose sight of some of these bigger issues.
Very good.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up just quickly on that issue, because we're right in the process of adding 17 rain gauges in the city of Seattle. Instantaneous rain gauges, because the 17 that are there now, all I got when we started having different kinds of storm events was, well, the quality assurance, quality control isn't very good, and we didn't really pay much attention to them for the last 10 or 15 years. And there, I looked at how much it is to install them, and it, relative to a $500 million budget a year, it's nothing. I think you ought to be going back and looking at what data you wish you had right now for making decisions and start putting that in place for whoever's going to follow you. Because, you know, we have an opportunity to make a small investment to stay with that small investment that's going to allow for better decision-making in the future, just like snowtell sites. They're so underfunded and so inappropriate, particularly in microclimates in some of our watersheds, that we're looking also at putting our own snowtell data sites in and managing those, because as you look to the future, it may be not just climate variability or regional variability, it may be microclimate variability, and we would like to be able to get better information on that. My guess is lots of people are doing the same thing, but it's not that difficult a step to do, and just sitting down and making some of those decisions may give you information that's really helpful in the future on making better decisions for your customers.
Does that make it difficult then for regions to exchange information?
I don't think
so. Is there a way
to
make that reliably uniform?
Yeah, for us, you know, with rain gauging data, probably nobody cares a whole heck of a lot about the city of Seattle, but we can have it. But the snowtell data will be done consistently with what's done by the federal government. So, mm-hmm. You know, there, other than maybe the quality assurance, quality control may actually be better because we're going to spend a little bit more money on it and more time on it. But I think it's easily transferable to others.
Thank you. Let's go back to the floor.
I have the mic.
Yes.
I just wanted to go back to a point that connects between the technical and the public engagement. It's one piece of the puzzle, but it provides a lot of opportunities. water efficiency provides most of the savings on the consumer side. I mean, the numbers that we've heard about, 18% of the electrical energy, 30% of the natural gas, almost all of that is not water agencies and wastewater treatment. It's heating the water in the homes, using the washing machines and so on. But saving that saves consumers money, which then engages people into, okay, maybe we should at some point listen to these engineers and listen to these people who are trying to create the models. That's the point I want to make.
Thank you. Yes, another here. Yes.
My name is Alan Wong. I'm with McCaffinetti. I wanted to tie into the first speaker who was from the private sector. I want to segue into the idea of an opportunity for public-private partnerships and collaboration. And I have an example in California here that's local to the San Francisco PUC also. The California Energy Commission has recently solicited grant applications for under their renewable fuels program. And they are willing to provide several millions of dollars to demonstrate the viability of technology that could be commercialized. So it's not research for research sake, but commercialized technology that would allow the fats, oils, and greases collected in all the food establishments in the urban areas in our country to be converted to a biodiesel fuel. And these collaborative opportunities are available. They've been used for many years now throughout the various states. And I think the opportunity is right in front of us to take advantage of these opportunities. In this particular case, you have the state of California. You have the Region 9 EPA, so you have a regulator. You have a utility, San Francisco PUC. You have the engineering community. You have manufacturers who are all ponying up, so to speak, and contributing to the funds that will be offered by the California Energy Commission. So I'd like to suggest that we, as a group here, recognize that those opportunities are out there and that we leverage those opportunities for the sake of reducing the carbon footprint. And if we do that, these are some near-term gains we can make as we do some of the more long-term research that's been discussed here in terms of the uncertainties and the hydrologic issues that will take, I think, a lot more time to resolve. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Right here.
Yes, thanks.
Claudia Trinino with the Water Environment Research Foundation. And I just want to come back down a little bit to something a little more in the specific side and add to the specific points. Chuck and I spent some time yesterday talking about infrastructure and knowing your infrastructure, knowing where your pipes are and your pumps are, what they can do and what they cannot do. I think yesterday was very enlightening to me as a wastewater person, listening a lot about infrastructure, and you're talking really, I'm thinking pipes and pumps, which I'm sure a lot of you are too, but you're talking dams and canals. And so I realize we do have to understand our language, and kind of part of that working together is going to be understanding each other's language. But what I wanted to add is there's been a tremendous amount of coordination and research on understanding and knowing dike pipes kind of work. And AWERF and WERF have worked together on a number of different things. And right now, for example, WERF has a huge strategic asset management effort ongoing. We're working with EPA to add a drinking water component to that. Bottom line, a tool for you to understand and know where your pipes are. You'll be surprised how many of our folks out there do not know. They have Joe, who's been there 100 years. He knows where the pipe is. And we rely on Joe to know where the pipe is, where the pump is. So when Joe retires, now we have a problem. So I think that we need to start remembering. We need to know where our pipes are and what their life is, what the decay curves are, so that we know how to invest, so we can make decisions about where to put those investments. So those tools are here. We can work with them. We can improve on them. And as we collect data, as we improve on our climate models, we can use some of those tools to talk to each other. So I think that one of the things I would like to leave on the table here is for the water and wastewater folks to be working together to understand and know where our pipes are so that Joe can retire in peace.
Thank you. Peter.
Yeah, of course, there's a classic engineering joke, which I will not tell, about Joe and his knowledge about where the pipes are, but it's apropos. The consensus issue came up. I want to tie a couple of things together. Was raised, and I just want to come back to this point that not everything is equally uncertain. And if you're looking for a consensus, temperature's going up. It's not going down. Sea level is going up. It's not going down. Snow melt in the western United States is going to melt faster, not slower. And runoff, the timing of runoff is going to change, with more runoff in the winter and less in the spring. Magnitudes, there's more uncertainty, but direction is often as important from a management point of view as magnitude. And we know a lot about direction. And so I could go on and on, but there is a very strong consensus about a number of things that lead to, as David said, some important no-regrets kinds of opportunities. And to get back to Costa's comment about comparative studies, I couldn't agree more. The value of some really effective comparative studies is hard to should not be underestimated. And let me give an example that Costa could have mentioned but didn't. That I have to say the Georgakakis brothers, of whom Costa is half, I guess, or there are three of you. I don't know how many of you there are, but have done a tremendous amount in this area, in the climate, variability, adaptability, comparative study area. And there was a study done, again, almost 7 years ago now, I believe, and I think by your brother, on the American River and on the flexibility of Folsom Reservoir under a range of different climate scenarios. They looked at a range of scenarios in terms of inflow to Folsom for hydro generation and flood damage under these climate change scenarios. And they ran the system with existing operating rules, and they got information about how much hydro could be produced and what the damages from floods would be downstream in Sacramento, which, as a lot of you know, is a really big concern. They then ran climate scenarios under existing operating rules and got some new information about hydro generation and flood damage. And flood damage went through the roof with some of these scenarios for increases in flows. But then they did some comparative studies of if you change the operating rules, what could you do? And it turns out that there are operating rules that could handle the scenarios that are coming, that would permit you to continue to generate hydropower, continue to have water supply in the summer, and hugely reduce flood damages. Will we implement those kinds of operating rules? I don't know. But the studies that suggest there's flexibility in the system are enormously valuable to water managers.
Thank you. Barry?
Just a practical suggestion. There's a theme running through almost everyone's presentations in the last day and a half that we need to do a better job of integrating a broader range of issues into the management of water systems. And one of the things water managers should do from a technical perspective is simply go back and look at the capacity of their agencies. And Peter made an excellent point, and that is with AB 32, for example, in California, and the PUC, for example, in California, looking at authorizing utilities, energy utilities, to make investments in energy efficiency and to make investments in water efficiency in order to save energy. That means if, as Peter recommended, if a water utility finds where those savings are, there may be energy utilities out there willing to partner with you in achieving those savings. So that sort of planning potentially brings new funding partners to the table, but only if the utility has the capacity to find those savings in a way that's compelling. And that's true with regard to reoperation, with regard to a number of the issues we've been discussing, flooding issues and so forth. So I think there's a very simple lesson there with regard to working with land use agencies, something that that some utilities don't do enough of. I think it makes a lot of sense for utilities to go back and look at their technical resources internally so that they can do a better job of doing the sort of integration that clearly there's a consensus we need to do more of in the future.
Can I add one specific recommendation? Another recommendation?
Please.
Every water utility should do a greenhouse gas inventory. What are your greenhouse gas emissions and where do they come from? Now, there may be no single tool that everybody agrees upon for counting and measuring, but there are tools out there. And it would be useful to have that baseline information, especially if the state's going to move to a cap, if you're going to get credit for reductions. You should all do them. And some of you might be starting that already.
Doug Wallace, East Bay Mud again. I'm glad you mentioned greenhouse gases categorically because our focus today in this conference has been on CO2, but there are other greenhouse gases, and methane comes to mind, many of which are much more potent for heat-trapping capacity than carbon dioxide. I know that carbon dioxide is the probably by far the largest amount, but there's an embedded question in my comment here that I'd like to know of these other greenhouse gases, what can water agencies do to manage methane production and other greenhouse gas emissions? So that's just part of the mix.
All right. I think one more on the far side, someone who hasn't spoken frequently in the fourth row.
Hi, I'm Paul Fleming with the Seattle Public Utilities, and I wanted to sort of expand on, I think, Barry's discussion about partners for potentially funding some of the greenhouse gas reduction efforts. I was recently at a conference in D.C. that focused on carbon markets and looking at the EU emissions trading scheme, and there's a lot of discussion about linking up with the California system that's going to be emerging, whatever that may be, along with the, I think it's the REGI system up in the Northeast. And there's this vast amounts of money that is being sort of managed to drive carbon out of various systems. And I think there's potential there for, particularly in California, if the systems link up, for utilities to potentially partner with funds that are, you know, that have billion-dollar funds that have been developed to essentially kind of harvest certified emission reductions and trade them perhaps in the EU or you know, even within California. So there would be a question about whether a community wants their emission credits to leave the community, but still there's going to be a lot of financial opportunities for utilities and others who may need some assistance to reduce their emissions.
All right, thank you. I think that we are just about out of time. And I wanted to just take the last couple of minutes, excuse me, to remind you that the website will be open. Laura, are you the expert on how long it will be open? You're going to talk about all of that, and that you have cards. You can put any comment on those. We said particularly if you had thoughts about what we as agencies together could do collectively to address and to both prevent and address the impacts of climate change. And question two was, what specific actions are you doing now to address climate change? What specific ideas would you like to share with other agencies and people involved in water supply? Thank you all so much for being so active and bringing such thoughtful comments to the general discussion. I want to thank our panelists for being energetic and having fresh thoughts after 36 hours of focusing on these issues, and say it's been a great pleasure to have you on a panel. Thank you.
SFGTV, San Francisco Government Television.